Hi everyone, you're listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we look forward to a world in which Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping traditions alive. I'm your host, Pamelia Chia, and today I'm joined by Evelyn Yap, who is a chef and founder of Happy Vo, which is a social enterprise platform that merges her love for food and her husband Calvin's talent for producing media content. Working closely with small-scale farmers and artisans in Thailand, Evelyn hosts supper clubs and dining events in Southeast Asia and the United States. In this conversation, she chats with me about her journey being a chef and supporting Thai farmers, as well as how her Singaporean roots have impacted her approach to food. Shall we start by finding out a little bit about your heritage and background? Can you tell me about the kind of upbringing that you've had in Singapore? What dialect group do you belong to?
So I was born and raised in Singapore. I'm the lucky ones who grew up with mom's cooking, and she's a great cook. And dad was an entrepreneur, but wasn't book smart, but he gave four kids a very comfortable life. So I was the youngest and actually had the most times with dad. So he actually had a car workshop. And because when I was young, I liked to eat Western food, Japanese food. So he will always bring me. And you can see that he doesn't enjoy it, but he's doing it because I like doing it. Yeah. So, but me and mom had a few rough years. It's only when I moved out of Singapore and we got better. My heritage is Nonya and Hokkien.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's my grandma, but my mom is not. But my mom still cooks Nonya food. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And then it's like after secondary school, I went to Shatec hoping to learn kitchen. But both my parents disapproved because it's like girls shouldn't be in the kitchen. And my aunt had to come in to be the middle person. And we had to sit down on a table and talk about it and come to a compromise that, okay, I can do the F&B side, but I can't do the cooking side. So I apprenticed at Hilton, and then after that, I was always sneaking into kitchen, sneaking into the chocolate rooms. And then after that, I did a couple of things like in selling supplements in GNC, selling wines. So looking back of what I have done, it's always the same industry, food, wine, service, and nutrition.
Yeah. So what were you doing at the Hilton?
Hilton, I was just doing, because they sponsored me, I got the scholarship, so I was doing all the front, so we were doing like lounge area, banquet area, and yeah.
Okay, and how did you eventually persuade your family members to allow you to be a chef? I know that you became a chef at the age of 33, is that right?
Yeah, because I moved out in China.
You moved to China.
Yes, and I started helping out my husband films production, and I was mainly doing with client relationship. But then I got sick due to the pollution and the lifestyle. As when I was in Singapore, everything is like so protected, you know. So there's no such thing as pollution. But China was really bad. It's like when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you check is the pollution index.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, which part of China were you in?
Beijing. I was in Beijing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was spending a lot of time in the doctors. Then I lost my taste bud at a point.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so we went to ENT but couldn't find out what was wrong. So I start taking matters in my own hand. So I start cooking for myself. I went vegetarian. I went raw food. I just went out 100%. Quit smoking. Quit drinking. Went for one cold turkey.
Oh my gosh, how was that? How was that like?
I think it just forced you to do that because
you have no choice.
Yeah, I have no choice. So it's almost like a survival mode. So eventually, I got back my taste bud. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen and found joy doing it. So Calvin did ask me, like, do I want to go back to cooking school? Do I want to go? I was like, I wasn't very sure at that time because it's like cooking is something you had to start young.
Mm, so true.
Yeah, and of course, the first thing the parents, like you say, the first thing they ask, you don't want to have kids?
Yeah, so, typical question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I know that you worked at this place called Rustic Canyon, and I absolutely love, I mean, I've never been, but I've been stalking them on Instagram, and I have the book on vegetables by Jeremy Fox, right?
Yes.
I really love the way that he approaches vegetable cooking. So can you tell me, why did you choose to work there? Was it because you were very into like vegetarian cooking and learning how to make vegetables delicious without meat?
Yeah, so I love and discovered vegetable is, like I told you, it's only because to heal myself.
Yeah.
And then how I landed into Rustic Canyon was I was a fangirl of Chef Jeremy. And then like you say, like some people still don't know who is he, but I would advise people to look him up and see Chef Jeremy. And he has a book called On Vegetable, like you say. And you can see amazing things that he can do with vegetables and bring it to fine dining standards. And it was ahead of the time at that moment as well.
Yeah.
So when I went to States for my honeymoon, I went Rustic Canyon to eat and to meet him. So I talked to him, telling him I was planning to go culinary school. And he gave me his email and told me, write to him when I'm ready. So when I completed my studies, I wrote to him. And to be honest, at that time when I went to the kitchen, I had no idea what they were cooking or what they were representing. But Rustic Canyon's farm-to-table ethos and culture had taught me and shaped me how I cook. And until now, I'm still very proud and lucky to be part of it. So, because it's like being in the kitchen for a few years now, it's like the kitchen that resonate with you have a very big impact on how you cook, how you approach to things. So for me, kitchen culture is actually a very important thing.
So what did you really learn from Chef Jeremy and his restaurant? I mean, coming from an Asian background, or, you know, Singapore, which is very, very like meat and seafood centric, right? It's, I think for someone of our age group, it's always on the table in almost every dish. To go from that to like eating no vegetables and cooking with vegetables, how do you think you adapted to that process, and what do you learn from the restaurant to make vegetables delicious?
I think when I was in Rustic Canyon, they will always have, every week we go to the farmer's market to pick up the produce, and then we will taste the produce at its prime. It's like something I think in Singapore, we don't have that that chance to try food at its prime, you know, because everything when it's imported, something is taken away.
Yeah.
And I think for when Chef Jeremy teaches you, show you the dishes, and he practiced the root to top
root
to root.
Stock.
Yeah, the leaf, the plant, So he teach you everything. And I remember we had a sit down after when I was leaving, and he gave me a one-to-one chat. And he was like saying, because there was this fava bean pesto that he did, and it was taking up, once we deshell the fava beans and then the shell, he asked me to roast the shell, and then we chop it up, because usually that part we just throw it away. And then he did ask me, is it the best pesto? Then I was like, to me it's like, it's not the best, but should I offend you or should I say the truth? So I say, it's not really. Then he say, yes, that's not the point. The point is to, because the farmers spend so much time and hours in cultivating this plant. So for us to just throw it away, have a think about it. So that was the part where the mentoring affected a lot. Yeah. Mm.
So, I mean, from back then, when you had no choice but to quit animal eating and like eating dairy and things like, are you a vegan or vegetarian?
Now? Flexitarian.
Yeah. Flexitarian. Okay. So, I mean, from back then, you know, you had no choice but to adopt a vegetarian mm-hmm. lifestyle. To now, do you genuinely enjoy eating vegetables?
Yes,
now?
I still do love enjoy eating vegetables more. So it's like even my daily lifestyle is probably lunch and breakfast is very controlled. So I always make meals plant-based for myself. But then dinner is the time where I add in a bit more protein so that the family members can eat. I don't want them to be feel tortured, you know. So,
Yeah. And so, you know, after being a chef, now you're in Thailand and you're doing some advocacy work. Is that the right way to put it? Can you tell me more about that transition and what exactly you do now?
Well, before I went into pursuing culinary, I was always inspired by those establishments that has an impact outside the four walls. I think it's the age thing where you have that kind of sensibility. So after being blown away by the time in California, I wanted to do something similar in Thailand. So Kelvin and I took a month driving up all over Thailand to visit organic farmers, hoping to find supplies at that time. But because that time organic is still quite niche.
Sorry, can I ask why Thailand?
Actually, Thailand was a pit stop. We were in Beijing, and then Thailand was a pit stop for me to go to school, and then we were planning to go Australia. And this road trip is the reason we are still here now.
Oh, yes. Wow.
So this road trip of the visiting to the farmers, and then when we have a bond with the farmers, they told us the challenges they were facing. And the climate change, industrialization, and systemic change. But bear in mind that I was born and raised in Singapore. All these things are very new. Being out in a farm is really very exhausting. And so when you hear such things, you feel a little shaken and injustice. So, yeah. I mean, you read a few topics here and there on the internet, but to have someone to tell you straight in the face is a different feeling. It has a so, and 5 years ago it was pretty uncharted water topic, so the information combining with the skills of what Kelvin and I have, so we decided to do supper clubs. So we invite people to the table, tell them the stories of the farmers, talk about food waste, climate change. And for a while, we were like the underground garage band, just doing our own thing. And we grew organically into the industry and cooking the food the way I want to cook. And also connecting to like-minded chefs to join powers to support farmers as well.
So what is the core mission of what you're doing right now? How are you helping farmers?
So right now, what we have been able to do is we, along the way, we have managed to pull some small-scale farmers to Michelin chefs. So they are getting produce from them. And then we also did, we did a fundraising before an event where to repair the broken roof of a farm. So, we are always trying to do little things one step at a time.
And how has working so closely with farmers impacted you as a cook and as a chef?
I think when you are so close to the source, it gives you different perspective. And like I said, it's we are more sensitive towards it, you know, as in it's not just a bag of rice.
Yeah.
But it's someone who has spent hours under the hot sun bending bags just to feed their family. So is it just a bag of rice? Or is it something more?
You know, after having moved to Thailand and having an intimate look at the way that some ingredients that we use back in Singapore, like gula melaka or mung beans, right, are produced, how do you think, I mean, what was your response to that?
I think I was like, holy shit, this is so much more work than what I expect, and there is such a deeper meaning and insight to food itself, because it's like something we consume every day, but we are so blind towards it, because it's like, it's just walk and then we get it, it's done, so we don't think about the stories behind how is it actually derived from. That's why it's like, I would suggest people to go get a pot, get some seeds, plant, and see if you have a new perspective from that.
So true. So I was looking at your Instagram and I realized that you champion a lot of regional ingredients that I think a lot of Singaporeans never ever cooked before, but is present at some of our markets. So things like cowslip flowers, right? So why did you feel this need to share about these kind of produce and shed light on it?
I think, to be honest, I never knew about all these vegetables as well when I was in. I only know about them when I moved to Thailand and went exploring into wet markets and visiting farmers. And sometimes they would just send me products from their farm and I learned from them. So I think because Singapore is also not an agriculture country, it really limits the kind of product we get, and we don't know what is out there because our habit have changed into more of supermarket as opposed to wet market. Because in wet market, I think there's more diverse products out there. So it's like one example, when I go back to Singapore to do pop-ups, and during the events before the main dish arrived, I usually throw a little curveball to the diners where I will serve a bowl of steamed heirloom rice. You can see people like puzzled, like, why are you serving me plain rice? But when we explain the product, the origins, how it is, and like the rice that we brought down is called Pet Ratri, and it's actually organic, grown from one farmer in Isan only. And it's a breed whereby she just played around and it has a certain aroma and taste and texture that is very special. And 80% of the harvest is given to wildlife eating. So they only harvest 20%. But in business standpoint, that doesn't make sense. But because it's so special, at the end of the dinner, people will just tell me, oh, I don't eat rice usually, but this rice was really special.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds so good. Like, so it's a lot of storytelling in your dinners, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about some of the interesting ingredients that your favorite ingredients that you have highlighted from Asia or from the region?
My favorite, I won't say favorite, but the ones that I consume more, I guess it's counted as favorite. Usually it's like green mangoes called kamin, but I'm not sure. I haven't been back to, in Singapore so long, I don't know if they carry
curcumin. That. Isn't that?
No, green mango. They call it gel kamin. There's this breed. There's so many breed. And I really like
green mango. Green mangoes are quite common in the wet markets, I feel. But I think a lot of people only know how to cook it in one way, which is like green mango salad, right?
Yeah. But actually, when you ferment it, or you can put it into sweet application, it's actually quite nice. Or actually, you just juice it and make it into ceviche. Yeah. Marinate, it makes sense. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds good. When I was working at a restaurant, one of our Indian kitchen helpers, right? She was preparing this dish of green mango curry, green mango and fish curry. And I was like, it was the first time I had ever tasted green mango cooked. And the texture was so nice. Oh. And it was like so appetizing. Have you ever had it in a curry?
No.
Oh, you should try. Just cut it. Yeah, cut it into cubes and then like allow it to simmer in the curry. It becomes like this super like silky, tender texture.
Cool. I'll try.
Yeah. So, okay, from a Singaporean perspective, right, you know, as I said, a lot of our food is imported. So I suppose a lot of listeners might be wondering, why should I care? You know, why should I care about how my food is grown in, like, say, Thailand, when I'm so disconnected from the whole supply chain and process? So what do you think is the point of relevance for Singaporeans?
People did ask me before many a times, even from when I do pop-up in Singapore and when I do dinners in Thailand, they're like, oh, thank you for showcasing our farmer. Yeah, thank you for making us proud. And then Singapore will be like, why do you have to do that, this and that? But actually, if you think about it, it's all connected. The food here grown is shipped to Singapore. So you are consuming it. So it's linked, it's connected. And at the end of the day, it's like we live on the same planet, you see. And I still think climate change is real. And yeah.
So other than climate change, what are some other social issues that you work with, Kelvin, to spotlight?
When we started, our intention was just to bridge the gap of diners and the farmers, showcasing the organic small-scale farmers, telling their stories along with it, hoping diners will get some new knowledge at the end of the day. And we did a lot of pop-up in farms, cooking in non-existent kitchen. It was really stressful, but it was something that we did. I think it's pretty cool to have that experience because not many people can do that. And along the way, like I mentioned, we did the fundraising project for the farm, fixing of the upkeepings. And in the first wave of COVID, a group of chefs and friends we came along and raised funds, cooked for the hungry, for the people at the slums. We are still doing it now until 2 years now. But since we are talking about COVID, the last 2 years have been difficult. Made me evaluate everything and saw how I came back to the loop of health. During COVID, I was down for a period of time. And, you know, then you read a lot of mental health issue rising, fear, a lot of uncertainty. But at the end of the day, there are so many things you can't control. But I know for sure everyone has control of their health. And so I am actually in the middle of pursuing holistic nutrition certified. I plan to be that platform to educate consumers, diners, the younger generation about all the nutritions and things, because I think food disorder, insecurity, mental health is something everyone goes through. And I think especially for a younger generation, I think right now it's difficult growing up in this generation whereby...
Why?
You know, when our generation, we had pages, we had pen pal, everything was like quite romantic, you know. But now, right now, those people, the younger generations right now is so in your face, social media, the kind of pressure I can't imagine. So I guess that's why the mental health is also rising. So that is why I've been posting on TikTok, though I still don't really know how to dance on TikTok, but I'm trying to show reach out to them by showing them how to cook something healthy for themselves. So it's like funny thing is I came back to why I started cooking again for health. So that's why to be taken more seriously, I had to get myself certified.
And I feel that that's something that a lot of people don't talk about, which is the link between the gut and like the mind, right? I think now more and more research is coming up about how the food that you eat can have a positive or negative impact on your mental health.
Because at the end of the day, the food that we eat, it provides nutrients to our body. And the kind, it's like the input you put to the body, it affects the whole human being. Sometimes even like a breathing exercise or whatever,
yeah,
it helps a lot, you know. Just doing like inhale 5 breath, hold for 7 seconds, breathe out 9 seconds.
Oh wow, that's like the meditation app.
Yeah, but you just do it for like less than a minute, you feel so much better and more clarity kind of stuff. I don't sound hippie.
Yeah, but from the perspective of mental health, right? So why can't people just go out and buy meals? Why do you think it's so important for them to learn how to cook their own meals to boost mental health?
Because it's like when you go out and buy food, firstly, the quality will always not be as good as the ones that you pick. And also, cooking is not just about the food intake, but it's also about the mindset. Because when you cook, it's kind of therapeutic as well. So it kind of slows you down and just shut off the world for a second and just focus on. I think this is kind of meditation itself. And when you actually cook for yourself, you take your time to eat more. That you eat more mindfully, and it's how does it? There's more intention.
Yeah.
Because when you buy from outside, you just like when you buy outside food, you just like gobble down in like, and then that's it. You know.
Yeah. And you actually know what goes into your food when you actually cook it yourself, right?
Yes.
So now that you're based in Thailand, and I mean you've been all over the world, China, US, now Thailand, how do you think your growing up years as a Singaporean or your identity as a Singaporean has really anchored you or influenced the way that you view food?
My Singaporean roots definitely exposed me to many cultures growing up, and that was the advantage I think for us Singaporeans to have, because we have embrace so many cultures and develop a palate since young, and that's why we have the ability to fusion dishes. And I know fusion is such a bad word, but I think it's like overrated, because if you take a step back and look at cuisines in the world, it's fusion everywhere, you know. It's like Japan ramen has Chinese roots, Indian food over centuries, like different parts of Indian food have different fusion depending which part they are at. Same like Thailand, it's like there's Laos, there's Chinese, there's Indian influence. So does that make fusion food bad? As long as it tastes good, no? At the end.
Yeah, but a lot of Singaporean cooking is also very fusion, right? I mean, you have like Hainanese cooking, which is like British and Chinese. And then like things like even laksa or, you know, any other national dish like chili crab. I don't know what a chili crab is. But things like satay bee hoon or things like yong tau foo. It's all a result of people mingling and putting their own spins on things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I also noticed what you said because so I'm not sure if you know, but currently I live rurally in Australia.
Okay.
And I realized that I grew up assuming that everyone grew up with such diverse options for food, or like they grew up being adventurous. But now when I'm here and I chat with my friends, you know, I realize that what we have in Singapore is a real gift, you know, this diversity that we don't realize. Yeah. So for you, like, how do you how did you harness this into the work that you currently do?
I think this became prominent as when I went into the career more, and then I cook more, because I don't usually cook Singapore food, but I use the influences and the, because I live in China, the exposure of food is another level, and I draw different parts of places I've been and infuse them in a way whereby it makes sense, you see. And I think usually Asian have a more sensitive palate. We are able to pick herb flavors more. I don't know why, or maybe I don't know.
Yeah. So can you give me some, can you give our listeners some tips on how to make vegetables delicious from all of your experiences, or like, you know, from your time in the restaurant, maybe, like, what are some of your favorite ways to make vegetables taste good?
I think for beginners, for vegetarian food, invest in spice and herbs. These will change your mind on how vegetables actually taste. Because actually, if you think about it, if you look at a piece of meat, you cook it, does it have more taste and flavor compared to a vegetable?
Yes, it does.
Really?
Like a piece of meat has so much umami, right? Because vegetables are very watery, in my opinion. I mean, I never used to like vegetables.
But and vegetables have sweet notes. Sweet notes, bitter notes.
Yeah, true. But I always feel that, because for me, right, I was a huge meat lover. And then after I started living in Australia, and like you, I was more aware of climate issues because of the bushfires and things like that. And so I started adopting a more vegetable-centric diet. And for the first few months, it was terrible. Like, I was constantly hungry. I always never felt satisfied. I kept craving for meat. And I felt that vegetables really do need a lot of care compared to meat. Like, for example, if you have a piece of steak, you can just salt and pepper and sear it on both sides and it will be like so delicious. But for vegetables, I mean, you can also do it the same, like, you know, treat it like a piece of meat. But I do think that they need a lot of help with like textures and flavors.
Yeah, that's for sure. Vegetables, you actually need to put a bit more effort to make it tasty.
Yeah, TLC.
So that's why it's like spices, all this comes into help to boost the flavors, and also you won't get bored eating, because I think for Asian especially, we always boil or stir fry. So it gets very boring with oyster sauce and fried onions and stress. I mean, how there's many ways you can eat vegetables, not just this way, you know. Yeah, so I think that's why people, from my knowledge, is people like vegetables if they are well prepared. And when sometimes people hear it's vegetarian food, they're like, ugh, it's because they always have bad experience with vegetarian restaurants and everything. So,
so true. And also, I think in Singapore, we always think of vegetables as like a side dish, right? Rather than like the main thing. So how do you make vegetables the main star of your meals, you know, that you serve at your supper club?
How do I say? It's like when I have a vegetable, I will think of how it tastes and then and try to make it interesting enough but yet familiar. You always need to have it familiar and not go way too far, because if you go too far away, people will not understand. So it's like one of the famous beet dish that we have at Happy Vor is basically we bake the beetroot and then we cut it thinly and shape into a perfect circle. And the excess, we will just juice it, and then we will dry the pulp and make it into beet soy. This was learned from Jeremy. And then the juice, I'll make it with homemade cheese and the whey liquid. So the whey liquid and the beet juice is made into the dressing.
Ooh, yum.
Yeah, so when people eat this, you can always see people, when they have a plate of beetroot, the face is like red. It goes red, like, no, no. Yeah. But when you tell them how to eat it, and then when they eat it, they won't stop. It's always clear.
Yeah. I think I've seen that dish. Like, it's quite a famous dish, right? At Rustic Canyon. I think they do with berries, if I'm not wrong. Is it berries and avocado?
That's the... Rustic Canyons did it with beets and berries. So my take is beets and homemade cheese and whey liquid.
Yeah. Oh, yum. I love that. Yeah. So how do you think you have really showcased the ingredients of Thailand through or Southeast Asia through your food?
Because all the dishes that we use for our dinners is always locally sourced. We don't use imported stuff, as much as people will always say, oh, there's no value. I don't feel there's value. There's no wagyu, there's no truffle and everything. Mm. But I think when they come in and sit down and have a meal here, listen to the story, what we have to say, they would understand. And most of the time, like when it's 14 guests, one of them will always have the mind change, and at the end of the day, they were like, oh, thank you so much for this. It has been very interesting. It gave me new knowledge and insight, and yeah. So wonderful. It's always like a win battle. At least one person, we managed to change one person, you know.
Mm. Yeah. I always find the tidbits that you share about the regional ingredients very interesting. Because, I mean, usually sometimes it's a lot of the plants that I've never worked with before.
Yeah, because even like the cowslip is like, usually when you ask a seller what to do with it, they'll tell you in Thailand, tom, gang, pat, meaning it's boil, curry or soup, and stir fry. So when they tell me this kind of thing, I usually will listen to them, go and try a recipe with one method and taste how the vegetable actually tastes. And then from there, you evolve and play with it. Just like the cowslipper pancake. To be honest, it's still tastier in soup as compared to the one that I did on the pancake. But I think it's just, I think when I do it on a pancake, it feels more accessible to people. People will be like, oh, you can do this. So they'll be more willing to go and try and just have fun.
I love that. I love that there is such a, I mean, it's such a great framework for learning how to use regional ingredients. I feel like people are always very hung up about the right way to use a vegetable rather than having that spirit of playfulness and you know, not being afraid to fail and to make something that doesn't taste like fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that I've definitely learned myself. Like, you know, how to regard every kitchen experience as not like, oh, success or failure. Because even if you fail, it's always a learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it's just food at the end of the day.
So true. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really loved finding out about, you know, the crazy, interesting things that you're doing. And yeah, I'm very jealous at all the Southeast Asian ingredients that you have on your fingertips.
Thank you for having me. I've been reading up and listening to your podcast recently. It's really good. It's really good, nice topics that you have covered. And I think for your age, I think you're doing very good as well. And it's like, It's so positive, you know, to see so many blooming individuals coming up. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You've been listening to Evelyn Yap of Happy Vore. We now stand at the crossroads where we're witnessing the vanishing of traditional dishes and the gradual erosion of our rich food culture. Now more than ever, we have to encourage one another to get back into the kitchen to cook food from our heritage. Singapore Noodles is offering a membership dedicated to equipping anyone with everything that they need to start cooking local. Visit sgpnoodles.com to find out more. Once again, thank you for listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a world where Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping traditions alive.